This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. My guest today says that going back centuries, all respiratory pandemics follow a script, one that's as much social and political as it is medical or epidemiological. He's Yale sociologist and medical doctor Nicholas Christakis, who has just released a new paperback edition of his authoritative and deeply researched book, Apollo's Arrow: The Profound and Enduring Impact of Coronavirus on the Way We Live. In our conversation, Christakis pulls no punches when slamming the failure of politicians and public health officials to act quickly and speak honestly with the American people throughout the course of a pandemic that has left 750,000 of us dead. As a newly minted member of the Advisory Council for the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE, and a high-profile target of ultra-woke campus activists, years back, he was the one being screamed at by angry Yale students. He also talks about how misinformation about COVID has been spread by pundits who seem to be more interested in pushing ideology than science, and why the best way forward, really the only way forward, is through robust debate in the public square. He also talks about how recent events on campuses, such as MIT's canceling a talk by a scientist due to his critical views on affirmative action, which were totally unrelated to the topic of his talk, underscore the need for a radical shift in favor of free speech at our colleges and universities. It's a fascinating, deep conversation in which you're going to learn not just about the Greek mythology behind Christakis' book title, but also what must happen so that we can finally put the COVID pandemic behind us. But before we get to the recent interview with Nicholas Christakis, I want to take a moment to introduce today's advertiser, Inkl.com. Inkl.com. If you're like me, keeping up with the news has become a real pain. All the best news sites are locked behind paywalls, and the free stuff is mostly just clickbait and fake news that nobody wants to waste time on. So imagine an app where you get unlocked access to the reliable news sites. An app that filters out fake news and clickbait, but still shows you every story from multiple perspectives to counter bias. Where good news, and by that I mean positive stories, is highlighted so you don't become despondent. And where journalists, actual human beings, dig through news from around the world to find stories you wouldn't normally see. That's what an innovative Australian startup called Inkl, INKL, has come up with. Inkl.com has signed partnerships with more than 100 news sources like The Economist, The Atlantic, and Bloomberg, and they've created a unique system combining journalists and algorithms to create a best of news feed. The service unlocks more than $12,000 of premium news for $100 a year. If you go to Inkl.com/reason, they'll give you an additional 25% discount. So you can get a whole year's worth of headache-free news for just $75. That's inkl.com/reason. And now, here's the Reason interview with Nicholas Christakis. Nicholas Christakis, thanks for talking to Reason.
Nick, thank you so much for having me back, actually.
Yes. We talked about Blueprint, your previous book, which was phenomenal. This one is conceivably more pressing in a way. Apollo's Arrow, the paperback edition. What's the elevator pitch for Apollo's Arrow?
Well, I guess I would say basically I was trying to write a kind of handbook that would help people understand where it is that this respiratory pandemic came from and where we're going. And I suppose the biggest overarching idea in the book might be this notion that everyone has, that we've come to live in this sort of crazy way right now, where it feels so alien and unnatural, but actually it's neither of those things. Plagues are an ancient part of our heritage. They're in the Bible. Plagues are in the Bible. The Iliad, the oldest work of Western literature, begins with a plague. They're in Shakespeare. They're in Cervantes. So I guess the elevator pitch is plagues are not new to our species. They're just new to us. We think they're it's crazy, but it's not.
Right. And you talk about how, in a way, we'll get to this towards the end, but how the way that we deal, both as a country, but also as a planet with the COVID pandemic is kind of a dry run for other collective challenges that are really beyond the scope of any, certainly any individual, but probably any particular country to deal with. So then, you know, this leads into, you mentioned the Iliad. What is the controlling metaphor of Apollo's arrow? This is, I realize as a Greek American, you are, you know, honor bound to introduce Greek mythology. If you were Norwegian, we'd be, I'm sure there's something from Norse mythology. But what's the controlling metaphor about Apollo's arrow?
I mean, all religions, actually, to my knowledge, all religions feature plagues, not just Christianity and Judaism and Islam, not just the Abrahamic religions. To my knowledge, all religions do. And the ancient and many polytheistic religions actually had the same god that was the god of healing, was also the god of illness. You know, the same god that made you sick could make you well. And this also was in ancient Greece, Apollo. And Apollo was the god of many things, but he was also the god of plagues. And actually, many ancient religions imagined plagues to be invisible arrows flung down by the gods, you know, that would suddenly sicken you. And I wouldn't say it's a controlling metaphor of the book, but it's certainly the opening, or the title of the book, and I do mention it early on in the book. And actually, what happened in the Iliad was that the Greeks had laid siege to Troy. And periodically, and the Iliad begins in the ninth year. They've been there for 9 years. And so the Iliad is at the finale of this of the Trojan War. And periodically, the Greeks would sack vassal cities of Troy. They would send out expeditions and kill all the men and take all the treasure and enslave all the women and children and bring them back to the camp. And they had done this for one nearby city. And they brought back to the camp slaves, basically, one of which was a maiden girl by the name of Chryseis, and she was given over to Agamemnon, the principal king of the Greeks. And her father, who survived the massacre and was a priest of Apollo, comes to the camp, beaches his boat, and brings a great ransom to ransom his daughter. And he goes up to the Greek encampment, and he winds his way through the tents, and he gets to Apollo's tent, and he falls on his knees, and he says, "Please free my daughter." And Apollo, in front of all of the, Agamemnon, the principal king, in front of all of these, all of the soldiers, not only refuses to release the girl, but also abuses the priest, smacks him and mocks him and says, you know, "Your daughter will grow old in my house, tending my loom, in my bed," you know, and the soldiers don't like this. They think this is really wrong. And so the priest leaves. And Apollo says, "Don't let me catch you skulking around the boats trying to catch a sight of your daughter." So Apollo, the priest, Chryseis was his name, goes down to the shore and he prays to Apollo. Remember, he was a priest of Apollo. And he says, "If I have ever given you a sacrifice my whole life that pleased you, hear me now, punish the Greeks." And Apollo is enraged. He instantly hears the prayer on Mount Olympus. And he takes his great silver bow and he flies down and he crouches among the Greek ships, invisible. He's a god. And the poem goes, "He unleashed his arrows. First he killed the running dogs, then the horses, then the men. 9 days through the army go the arrows of the god, and the funeral pyres burnt night and day, until on the 10th day, Hera, the queen of the gods, took pity on the Greeks, for she saw them perishing." And this begins, you know, the canonical work of Western fiction. So these are an ancient experience we've had. By the way, and I'll shut up in 1 second. By the way, when I saw this past summer, the funeral pyres burning in India night and day, so intense was the toll of death that they, you know, they ran out of oxygen for their hospitals. They ran out of hospital beds. They ran out of medicine. They started to run out of wood because they couldn't burn the bodies fast enough. I thought again of this, of the Iliad. Or in New York last March of 2020, we were running out of freezer space. You know, the bodies were piling up so fast. In the 21st century of the United States, the impact of the epidemic was so large that we didn't have the capacity to deal with the bodies. And this is a very ancient human experience, very painful, very primal, very fundamental.
And I guess we don't have Hera to rely on, right? We're going to get ourselves out of this situation. So, you know, you write about how all pandemics follow a script. And you also note towards the beginning of the book that recoveries or the end of pandemics and what comes next also follow a script. And we'll get to that in a little bit. What's the script that the COVID pandemic has been following?
Well, I wouldn't say that all pandemics follow a script. I would say all respiratory pandemics, which are a subtype.
Okay.
And if you look, we have good records going back. Well, we have records regarding pandemics going back thousands of years. And so we have good records regarding respiratory pandemics for the last century. You know, the 1918 influenza pandemic, the 1957 influenza pandemic, the 1890 respiratory pandemic, and so on. 2009 H1N1 pandemic, the 2003 coronavirus pandemic, SARS-1. Anyway, and if you look at all these, you can divide respiratory pandemics into three periods. The immediate period, the intermediate period, and the post-pandemic period. The immediate period is the period in which we feel the biological and epidemiological impact of the virus. You know, from the point of view of evolutionary biology, what's happening to us right now is actually quite an unusual event, which is that a new pathogen has been introduced into our midst. And this pathogen is now going to circulate among us forever. The pathogen is having what is called an ecological release. It's like if we released rats, you know, on an isolated island in the Pacific, and the rats like overran the place. You know, they just had a heyday. Our bodies are that island to the virus, which is the rats. And the virus is just going to spread and spread and spread among us till it covers the whole planet, basically. And so the immediate period is the period in which the virus is doing that, and everyone is eventually. People either have to acquire natural immunity to the virus because they were infected and survived, or be vaccinated. And then we reach this something called the herd immunity threshold, and the virus becomes what is known as endemic. It just sort of has a low background rate. And that marks the end of the immediate phase. And for the coronavirus pandemic, we're now, as I said in the book, and as is happening, that will last until sometime in 2022. And then in 2022, certainly in the United States, but eventually in the whole world, we need to get there. We will reach this herd immunity threshold, and then we'll cross into the intermediate phase. And the way to think about the intermediate phase is the immediate phase was about the biological and epidemiological impact of the virus, but the intermediate phase is about the kind of recovering from the clinical, psychological, social, and economic aftershocks. Because like a tsunami washing ashore, you know, that devastates the countryside. Eventually, the waters recede, but we got to clean up the mess, and we're going to have a mess to clean up here. We've had millions of children miss school, millions of businesses close, millions of workers lose their jobs. We're borrowing trillions of dollars from the future to cope with it. Now we're going to have millions of people that survive the disease but are disabled by it, which isn't getting a lot of attention. All of that's going to need our attention. And then finally, sometime in 2024, approximately, we'll cross into the post-pandemic period. And I think that is going to be a little bit of a party, like the roaring 20s of the 21st century, like the roaring 20s of the 20th century. And I think if you think about it, it's very intuitive. Just like any other calamity that afflicts a population, like a war or a famine or an earthquake or a plague, the survivors will rejoice, right? Will be relieved. And what's going to happen is we'll all have been cooped up for so long, had such constrained lives. We're going to, you know, party. You know, people are going to relentlessly seek out social interactions and nightclubs and restaurants and bars and sporting events and political rallies. I think we're going to have a lot of political ferment in this country. We might see some sexual licentiousness. You know, my sister always says whenever I make this prediction, I need to be careful to clarify that this prediction only applies to unmarried couples.
Yes, this is a family show.
I'm almost done. And then there's going to be, I think, economic boom. You know, people save their money during plagues. We've seen that in this country right now. They're going to start spending their money. There's going to be, I think, an efflorescence of the arts. And so finally, you know, we will put it behind us. Anyway, those are the phases that are typical of serious pandemics.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned that this is the most serious pandemic, respiratory pandemic, since the 1918 flu epidemic. And I'll just point out, because I think this is meaningful in many ways, you know, we call it the Spanish flu, but as you point out, you know, all signs point to it beginning in Kansas, which is a little bit west of Spain. And there's always that interest in kind of blaming somebody, right? Blaming the other for what's among you. But I mean, I guess there is a question of like, will we have America's roaring 20s or will we have Germany's hyperinflationary 1920s?
Well, right? That's very hard for me to forecast. I am mystified. You know, classic economics is that when we're basically printing money right now under the Trump administration, I think we borrowed like $2 trillion. And now with the Biden administration, we're borrowing another $1 trillion. So that's like $3 trillion so far. You know, classically, when you print money, you get inflation. Now, it's a little more complicated than that, as I'm sure you and many listeners know, which is it also depends on something known as the velocity of the money. So in other words, if you print the money and distribute it, but people put it under their mattress and they don't spend it, which is the velocity, the turnover of the money, then you don't necessarily get as much inflation. And of course, the modern Fed has many tools at its disposal to try to tame inflation. But I'm worried about that, honestly, eventually. And there's no doubt we're going to have to repay the debt, right? Like one of the reasons, so here's the other thing that's really scary to me about what's happening right now is you and I are talking in this, I would say, natural way about this calamity, but 750,000 Americans have died, 750,000. Probably as many as 1 million will die before this is over. And I had forecast that back in August of 2020. And part of the reason life is continuing somewhat as normal is that we are kind of, the plague is deadly, but not so deadly that everybody knows someone who's died, right? Like maybe 10 million Americans know someone who died intimately. And we're 330 million Americans. So most Americans don't know anyone who died. And we are borrowing money from the future to kind of smooth over the present. And so I don't think people really appreciate what has hit us yet. I think we're kind of a little bit whistling by the graveyard. But I think we have suffered an absolute catastrophe. And I'll say one more thing and then I'll shut up. Larry Summers, a former Treasury Secretary, and David Cutler, a former colleague of mine at Harvard and a health economist, published a paper about eight months ago now, calling this the $16 trillion virus. In the United States, we suffered $8 trillion of damage, economic damage from the virus, and $8 trillion of health damage, the death, disability, and illness. This amount of money is a catastrophic loss. It would be as if I went to every family of four in this country and took $200,000 away from them and flushed it down the toilet. Or if we burned to the ground tens of millions of American homes. I don't think people fully understand how big a loss this is to us.
Yeah, that's essentially almost the size of the annual economy in the United States.
Yeah, it's bigger than the Great Depression. I mean, this is a huge loss.
You're critical in the book of the way that the federal government and most state governments have handled the pandemic. Let's start with the way officials responded early on to cases in Washington State and later New York, which became not just the American epicenter, but the global epicenter. What went wrong and what went right?
Well, I think I get the sense I'm giving long-winded answers. So this one is especially not good to
Well, I mean, you know, what from the beginning, because it's funny, you know, this is only 18 months ago, but it seems like ancient history of what happened in Washington State and then New York. And I was living in New York and I remember going out the last weekend you were allowed to go out and, you know, the mayor and the governor were saying, hey, you know, the economy needs you. Go out there and spend your last dollar.
Yeah, I think de Blasio and Cuomo greatly misstepped in early March. And along with other epidemiologists, for example, they were planning on having the St. Patrick's Day parade. And we wrote a letter saying, this is nuts. You can't have a St. Patrick's Day parade in New York in March. But here's just to back up just a tiny bit. So I have a longstanding collaboration with some Chinese scientists, some colleagues in Hong Kong. And we'd been using phone data to study human social interactions, which is something I study in my lab, social networks and the structure of human social interactions and how that how that structure affects the spread of ideas or the spread of germs or spread of behaviors and so on. And we'd been using these data from phone data where we could trace where people are and who they're talking to and hence their networks to study things like when you build a high-speed rail line, how does that affect economic interactions in a community, for example? And we realized in January of 2020 that we could use these data to study the pandemic, which was then new. And we had data on 11 million people transiting through Wuhan, which happened to be where it started, and spreading out through the rest of China. So we scrambled to write a paper about this, which was published in April of 2020 in a journal called Nature. And because of this, I was paying attention to the pandemic. I would have eventually been paying attention, but I really got a jump start on paying attention in January of 2020 because of this collaboration. And therefore, I was aware that on January the 24th, the Chinese government had promulgated regulations requiring 930 million people to stay at home. So it's an authoritarian government, a collectivist culture. They ordered a billion people to go home and lock their doors. And they did. And this really got my attention because it was clear to me, even though then there wasn't a lot of information being released, I mean, the Chinese Communist Party is quite a secretive enterprise. They saw in the virus an enemy of sufficient magnitude that they essentially detonated a social nuclear weapon to stop it. Meanwhile, in the United States, the president was saying, never mind, never mind. And many other people were too. My epidemiology colleagues and I were alarmed. And if there's some calculations you can do based on numbers that were being released by the Chinese scientists back then that allowed us to forecast the severity of this epidemic. And even if you had imagined that, okay, maybe in February, it was okay to put our head in the sand in early February, by late February, Italy had collapsed, a rich Western democracy. Okay, we saw what happened in Lombardy. And still the discourse in this country was, never mind, never mind. The president of the United States is saying, it's going to go away, it's going to go away, it's going to go away. And I know the history of pandemics, and I know that denial is a typical response to plagues, not only in our politicians, but the person on the street. So I was very, very alarmed because I saw in us not only an ignorant public, and by ignorant, I don't mean stupid, I mean unaware, like a public that was not aware of the threat that was bearing down on us. And I saw self-interested politicians whose job it is the plague of this kind has been seen as a national security threat by right-wing and left-wing administrations for decades in the United States. People rightly recognize that this type of a serious respiratory pandemic is a national security threat, and the president of the United States is supposed to protect us from that. I mean, that's his job. And yet I saw nothing to prepare us. So here's where the big mistakes occurred. In that interval of time when China lockdown and Italy collapsed, there should have been a huge all hands on deck preparation in this country. We should have been manufacturing PPE. Remember, we had no PPE. Hundreds of thousands of Americans died alone because there was no PPE to give their loved ones to visit them in the hospital, or because the hospitals were so inundated that healthcare personnel could not be spared to facilitate these meetings. So as a former hospice doctor, this idea that anybody, let alone Americans, rich Americans, would die alone is appalling. I mean, it's immoral. So we had no PPE. Remember, we had no ventilators. There was concern about ventilators. We had no public preparations. We weren't preparing the public for sacrifice. No one was calling us to arms saying, we are being invaded by a germ. We need to work together. Some people will lose their lives. Some people are going to lose their livelihoods. Rich people are going to have to pay more taxes. This is going to be a national problem. None of that was happening. No education. No, like, let's have scientists on TV saying, this is what we know about respiratory pandemics. After Italy collapsed, for sure we should have had Tony Fauci on TV or pick someone else. Doesn't matter. Somebody saying, this is what's known about respiratory pandemics. We have the world's best scientists who understand what this is, and here's what they're going to tell you about it, et cetera. We had none of that. So I think, and then the testing was a complete flop. It was a goof scientifically initially, where there was an error in the manufacturing of one of the components of the test, but then that was compounded by a bureaucratic failings where they could have, with a wave of their hand, basically released the states and released hospitals to do their own testing. Right. They didn't.
So, I mean, this is where the CDC asserted a monopoly on the testing apparatus and then introduced a bad test to begin.
Well, what the crucial error, well, the CDC has previously been able to rapidly develop tests. In this particular case, I think because of a faulty laboratory procedure, one of the three components of the test was defective. They could have said, never mind, use the test anyway omit the defective step. Or what they could have done is they could have, any elite hospital in this country, every state has at least one hospital that can make their test, there's their own test. That was the FDA actually that had to allow this to happen. But the president of the United States could have ordered this, right? The president's a national emergency. We're going to just unleash American ingenuity to start, you know, testing. We didn't do that. So we had countless problems. It was amateur hour. And I'll just shut up in 1 second. What was so disappointing to me was that, look, thankfully we are not China. I'm not suggesting we should have locked everyone down like the Chinese should have. We have our own strengths as a people. We are a free and open society. We have open, free expression. We have a mass media that is, you know, is allowed to say whatever they want. We are rich. We're a wealthy nation. We have the world's best scientists, as shown by the fact that we developed vaccines that are fantastic. You know, we did not bring our best game to this challenge. You know, we were Keystone copying it. And I think, although this virus is sufficiently intrinsically deadly that from the moment it entered our species, we would have lost 200,000 or 300,000 or 400,000 American lives. I think we lost several extra 100,000 deaths because of the incompetence, certainly at the federal level in the past administration and at various state levels too.
Yeah. So what did New York do wrong?
Well, New York was nuts.
You know,
I mean, New York was basically all the same kind of goofs, right? Like in early March, when both the governor of New York and and by the way, they were both Democratic and Republican governors. I mean, the Texas governor is a Republican. He was also, and Alabama, I'm sorry, Georgia, where the governor was just saying ridiculous things, and the CDC is in his own state. You know, he says, I didn't know that there was asymptomatic transmission. I'm like, how could you not know there was asymptomatic? He says this in April. I'm like, just pick up the phone and call the guy down the street. Anyway, so Cuomo, of course, was a Democrat. This sort of this false reassurance in March, and not telling people to reduce their social interactions or not preparing the public better, I think was a big mistake. And I remember they were saying, they had this overconfidence in the New York City healthcare system. Our hospitals can take care of this. And then two weeks later, they were saying, any veterinarian with an extra ventilator, please, you know, call us so we can have it. I mean, just a ridiculous turnabout in 14 days, which was obvious. I mean, to people like me, it was obvious. We were saying it at the time. It's not like in retrospect I'm saying this. I was saying it back then. So, yeah. So there were many mistakes.
What is the evidence, on the longer tail now that shelter in place orders and reduced social interaction? How do we know that that's an effective way to combat?
That's a very good question. So first of all, there are very few randomized controlled trials of such mass interventions, you know, like randomized controlled trial of school closure, randomized controlled trial of masking. There have been some randomized controlled trials of masking, but it's rare. A randomized controlled trial of gathering bans. So there aren't many, if any, randomized controlled trials. But there are now, both for historical epidemics and for this one, many high-quality statistical analyses of the benefits of these interventions. Before we discuss lockdowns, let me just put on the table this notion that's called the Swiss cheese model of pandemic response. So the Swiss cheese model is a model of failure of complex socio-technical systems that was put forward by a psychologist by the name of James Reason over 30 years ago to study airplane crashes and nuclear power failures and eventually medical errors, like why do patients get the wrong drug in a hospital? It's a sequence of all kinds of mistakes that results in this.
He's like the father of the checklist.
No, that's right? A different guy.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Sorry. But continue. Yeah, okay. Yeah, with the Swiss
cheese. The checklist is a way to help cope with this.
Yeah.
So the Swiss cheese model, says that each layer of defense, like masking is a layer of defense, and school closure is a layer of defense, and border closure is a layer of defense, and quarantine is a layer of defense, and testing is a layer of defense, and hand washing is a layer of defense, and vaccination is a layer of defense. Each of these layers of defense is good, but not perfect. It's like a piece of Swiss cheese that has some holes in it, a certain number of holes, certain size of holes, certain location of the holes. And you should have the intuition that if you have one layer of defense, you know, if the virus is approaching this piece of Swiss cheese, if it happens to hit a hole, it will penetrate and go through. In defense, this is known as defense in depth. You know, you don't just have one anti-aircraft battery, right? Because what if a plane makes it over? You have others that are 50 miles inland, or, you know, you have additional defense. Okay, so but you should have the intuition that if you have multiple pieces of Swiss cheese, by the third slice of Swiss cheese, none of the holes will line up, right? That as you make a sandwich, you pile up the pieces. By the third or fourth slice, you look at the stack of cheese, you can't see through it. So anyway, so that's the Swiss cheese model of defense. So now, so scientists have studied all of these layers. And see, these layers were introduced at different times in different countries to different extents. So taking in different states and in different counties. So people have studied this and tried to assess controlling for the other layers, controlling for masking, does school closure matter? And the bottom line is that we have robust evidence that each of these defenses works. School closure works. You know, some studies find it does, some studies find it doesn't, but overall the evidence is that it works. Masking works. And there's you know, I just need to be clear, maybe it works in some countries, but not in others, at some places, but in others, in some moments in the pandemic, but not in others. But overall, if you look at the evidence, and when it comes finally to lockdown, some people, and there's a lot of confusion about this, some people say lockdowns don't work, but it depends on what you mean by that. If you mean after we've closed the schools and closed the borders and had everyone wear masks and banned gatherings, there's no further benefit from ordering people to stay at home, maybe that's true. But functionally, you've done the lockdown by all these other layers of Swiss cheese, you see? So anyway, I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah, well, from a libertarian perspective, you know, there's a lot to think about with this because, you know, collective action always presents, you know, various kinds of philosophical yes. Or ideological issues. But, you know, when we're looking at like death rates now in states like California, New York, Florida, and Texas, right, all of whom kind of followed, you know, in the end, everybody was kind of doing similar things, but they were a little bit different. California has 184 deaths per 100,000, New York 289, Florida 281, Texas 249. Are these differences statistically meaningful? And do they reflect, you know, do they reflect the strategies that are implemented by various authorities? Do they reflect the way that, you know, people there acted with knowledge that was given to them, maybe not forced on them? How much do the demographics? Florida has 20% of its population is over 65. It has triple the number of blacks who are at higher risk than California does. I mean, how do we make yeah. sense of these differential outcomes?
So this is complicated and it's difficult to be certain. Always during pandemics, there's tremendous variation from place to place in deaths. For example, in the 1957 flu pandemic, Chile had 30 times the attack rate that Egypt did. And right now, there's a lot of conversation about how in sub-Saharan Africa, how COVID is like a rich white man's disease, you know, and that they're somehow immune. Well, no, the median age in sub-Saharan African countries is like 17 or 18, and the median age in Italy is 47. And the median age in the United States is 38. So since we know that the virus kills the elderly at a vastly higher rates than the young, a younger country, of course, is going to have a much lower fatality rate. And the same applies within our country. Some states vary by their age, and so younger states, and as you suggested that. So some of the variation from place to place is going to depend on intrinsic properties of the place. How rich is it? What's its climate? What's its age? What's the average age? What are the household arrangements? You know, Italy has intergenerational households and Sweden does not. The Italians live with their grandparents. The Swedes do not. that's going to affect it. You know, like the average size of the household, all of these things play a role. So there are three components in variation from place to place. You put New York, Texas, and California on the table. One thing we've got to look at is the demographic and environmental factors, the weather, the wealth, the hospital infrastructure, the age, the household arrangements, and so on, the ethno-racial backdrop, so on. The second thing we've got to look at is the intervention strategy. You know, what did they do and when? Keep in mind that New York bore the brunt of it before people really knew what was going on as much, and before the vaccines were available. So it's not quite fair to say, well, just as many people, if I told you just as many people died in one place before the vaccines were available as died in another place after the vaccines were available, you'd say, well, wait a minute, what's wrong with that second place? Why didn't they get vaccinated? So one thing has to do with the environmental and demographic components. The second thing has to do with the interventions. What did they do and when did they do it? And the third thing is chance. There's just a play of chance. And I think that Florida, people talk about Florida a lot. I think DeSantis just got lucky, actually. Some of it is the Florida weather. Some of it is a bunch of other things, you know, but I think he just got lucky. And, you know, so those, and it's very difficult to be certain what explained it.
Where did the strategy of lockdowns come from? Because, you know, and obviously the 1918.
One thing to your libertarian point. You know, I'm very sympathetic to a lot of libertarian arguments. I mean, I in my own politics or ideology, I would say I'm very pragmatic. I mean, I want to live in a high functioning society. And if the market solutions are what we need, great. If the libertarian idea is really the optimal way to, great. If the kind of liberal, state intervention is what's needed. So if you think about like an invading army, the libertarian posture in an invading army is, oh no, for an invasion, the state needs to conscript soldiers and equip them and organize them and move them to the front. You know, I believe that's the libertarian position on an invading army. I have one friend.
So,
about this guy. I have one extremely libertarian friend who I adore. But anyway, I don't think even he would argue that, no, every man for
there are times when, you know, states of emergency aren't declared and the state can act untoward way.
So I would argue that a plague is like an invading army. Yeah. It is intrinsically collective threat. It's not something that afflicts us solely as individuals. We transmit the virus to others. We impose externalities on others. It's the classic, you know, your right to swing your fist stops at my nose. Well, your right to infect me, you know, you do not have the right to infect me. You cannot act as a thoughtless vector for a contagious disease.
But then there was a real, and, you know, and I say this, I'm talking to you from NoHo in Manhattan. So, you know, the double dose of Andrew Cuomo, who was incompetent, and Bill de Blasio, who was incompetent, dictating what is an essential and non-essential business.
Yes, that was ridiculous.
And how do you factor in the kind of arbitrariness of certain actions into figuring out what makes for first an effective public health response, but then also one that respects people's liberty, even in times of stress?
Yeah, I think that is, in fairness, that is a difficult balance and a difficult test. I would do it as much as possible. I would publicly state my reasons, and I would do it as much as possible non-ideologically. So I would state, for example, you know, we deem grocery stores, an essential business because people need to buy food. I think it was in Spain, they deemed hair salons an essential business because, you know, staying attractive was, you know, deemed essential. And I think and tobacco stores, you know, like tobacconists were deemed an essential. So obviously it'll be
liquor stores here were first not considered essential, and then very quickly they became essential. And it kind of makes sense, but then it becomes, you know, one of the questions that a lot of people I asked and a lot of people I worked with asked is, once we know the risk, the relative risk going on, is it better to allow individuals and businesses to set their risk tolerance, to say, we're going to be opened up, we're going to follow these protocols because these are the best, you know, ideas that we have, but then devolve the decision-making to individuals rather than to Gracie Mansion?
It depends. I think it's hard. It's like, you know, it would be just, again, the analogy would be an invading army. Yeah. You know, we can't have the soldiers decide what weapon they, you know, I don't really like the government issue rifle. So I'm going to have my, I want my own rifle. You know, we were like, no, we can't have every man have a different rifle. We need to have the same ammunition. We need to be able to.
And certainly the severity, I mean, this is also something that comes in. It is staggering to think that 750,000 Americans have died. That's, you know, more than in any war. Certainly, I mean, it is a major, major event. But the infection fatality rate is, you know, relatively low for a disease like this versus something like smallpox, where it seems like I don't know anybody who would say, you know what, people should be allowed to do whatever they want in a smallpox.
Well, but that's a very good point you just made. And I try to make that in the book in a way we have had a kind of pandemic light experience because the disease is serious enough to cause us woe. It kills 1%. That is actually from an infectious disease point of view, that's a rather serious illness. But it's nowhere near as deadly as cholera or smallpox or bubonic plague. In the movie Contagion, which is a terrific movie, the infection fatality rate is about 30% in that movie. About one out of three people die, if you just sort of guesstimate looking at the movie, who are infected. And this pathogen, by the way, it's just by the luck of, you know, by the luck of our, what's the skin of our teeth or whatever the expression is, that it wasn't more deadly. I mean, there are coronaviruses that kill about 30% of the people they infect, like Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, MERS, which kills about 30%. If this virus had killed 30%, we would have been facing a bubonic plague type catastrophe in the 21st century of the United States. And in that movie, remember in Contagion, the army is called out, they're distributing meals, there's no fuel, people are cold. I mean, it's a complete breakdown in civilization. So yes, these are national security threats, and yes, they're exigent circumstances. Now, going back to your question, I think the duty of the government is to justify whatever it is that they're doing, be unideological about it. So, for example, if we ban gatherings of 10 people, that means no church services, but also no protests. Mm-hmm. You know, it means, right. You know, it means we are going to be...
This is one of the real subtexts, right? Of I think of our, you know, when you talk about in the book how there is a social dimension to these kinds of experiences, and this is something that drove a lot of people kind of mad that the government was, you know, clearly incompetent in various ways, but then they kind of hid their motivation or their reasoning for a lot of things, and then you had a lot of experts saying, you know, you cannot go out and gather unless it's for a George Floyd
yes.
protest, and then it's okay. Or, you know, and then you have people who are saying, like, I should
people,
be allowed.
By the way.
Oh, no, I know that. But you also had people, you know, in other contexts saying, you know, Black Lives Matter rallies should be banned, but I want to go to my mega
yes.
church because, you know, that's a good thing. You know, this is part of the problem. This is, you know, it comes at a point in time when trust and confidence in government and other forms of authority in the private sector, you know, business and churches and everything is at a low, but then it really kind of poured a lot of gasoline on that fire, right? In trust and confidence.
Yes. I mean, this is one of the things that's so sad and ironic is not the right word, but it's poignant and almost that the virus struck us at a particularly vulnerable moment in our history. Before the virus struck, we already had century-high levels of economic inequality, right? So a lot of tension in our society along economic grounds. We had decades high levels of political polarization. I think since, like, you have to go back 50 years before we had equivalent levels of political polarization. We had a kind of anti-elitism that was very ascendant, where people were very distrustful, which is a bit odd, by the way, because I've never understood that exactly, because this anti-elitism has then feathered into a kind of opposition to expertise, you know, kind of the scientists, what do they know? And by the way, this is on the right and on the left. People speak about my truth, right? That's a very popular expression on the left, you know, my truth. No, it's not your truth. It's your truth.
But you have expertise, so you're like, what is
yes.
wrong with these people? But it is, you know, when you hear somebody like Anthony Fauci say, don't wear a mask, masks are a bad idea, and then later admitting, well, I said that because I was, you know, it was a version of a noble lie.
Yeah, that was this, a big,
that's not help. That's
no, that
not
was
helping,
a big
right?
mistake. And I don't know Tony Fauci personally, but I've been reading his work. I do have a lot of respect for him. He was writing about respiratory pandemics when I was in high school. I mean, a lot of the
right,
key work
right,
has
yeah.
been done in his lab.
So
but
just to kind of...
No, but yeah, what I was going to say is, and we can come back to like the science and what the scientists did right and did wrong and so on. But my point was, Our economy relies on expertise. When you have a problem with your car, when you need a surgeon, you need a cabinet maker, you need a plumber, you trade your dollars for someone who's made it their life's work to address that problem. And it's the same with respiratory pandemics. There are people like me and others who've spent a lot of time studying exactly this topic. And we are a rich nation that has decades of tradition of commitment to science. And what really sort of made me laugh was that people were using this device, which was invented by scientists and engineers based on centuries of hard work, to tweet out comments that what do the scientists know?
Well, this is one of the things we're great at, is becoming instant experts, right? I mean, we're, you know, it wasn't so long ago that we all understood the, you know, properties of jet fuel on structural steel for 15 minutes.
Let me just finish the point. I know we have, I mean, I'm at your disposal. We can talk as long as you want. But what I wanted to finish was, is that the virus, you see, relentlessly exploited all these divisions. And finally, we have lost in our public, in our civic discourse, in our public life, we've lost the capacity for nuance. People are, you know, you're with me or you're against me. It's black or white. It's either this way or it's that way. We don't kind of have centrist positions or compromise positions or saying it's difficult. Yes, this, but that. And so here's what we're going to do that respects these conflicting concerns. People want simple answers, but they're not going to get them. And this is because of all of those problems. The virus, just like, as you pointed out, was like a wedge, you know, exploiting each of these things and killing us as a result of that.
So let's talk about vaccines. You know, how big a game changer are vaccines? Because this is another point of contention that feeds into, you know, a relatively high percentage of people who are vaccine hesitant or vaccine resistant. But, you know, we were simultaneously told, you know, hang on for vaccines. They're going to take 3 to 5 years to get here. They come out, you know, in a year. They're effective, they're safe. But then we're told, you know, once you have a vaccine, at first it was you get vaccinated and then things can go back to normal. But then it's like, get a vaccine, but nothing changes. How big a change is our vaccines, and how do we move forward to get more, you know, more the number of people, the percentage of people to take vaccines so that we can actually get rid of any worries about a pandemic and allow COVID to become.
So there are like 10 different topics in what you just said. First of all, I need to mention that one of the things that unexpectedly happened with this virus is that new mutants arose, which were more contagious and more deadly. So the Delta variant is twice as infectious. It has an R naught of 6, a basic reproduction number. That means each case can intrinsically create 6 new cases compared to the original Wuhan strain, which had an R naught of about 3. And it was about 30 to 40% more deadly. Right.
And normally, if you have a higher rate of infection, it's less deadly, right? So this is kind of, you know, this is a very devious, virus.
It had both of those. That's right. And we can go into that. But this particular strain had a couple of properties that made it much worse, which appeared after the vaccines were available. So it kind of mucked up the forecast a little bit. But the point is, it's not just about whether you get vaccinated. The whole society or a critical number, the so-called herd immunity threshold, has to be vaccinated before you can return to normal. And because of the Delta variant, that percentage of people now is about 90%. It's going to be some very large number. So basically, what's going to happen now, first in the United States, and eventually the whole world needs to go through this period, is you've got two choices. Unless you're a hermit in the mountains, or you're very lucky, either you will be vaccinated or you will be infected. Those are your choices. If you're infected, you've got a 1% chance of death. If you're vaccinated, you've got a 1 in a million chance of death. To me, it's a very obvious choice. This fantasy that somehow, oh, I'll just squeak by, is not going to happen because of the Delta variant. And we have to, all of us, either we have to acquire a level of immunity, about 90% have to acquire immunity, either through vaccination, preferably, or through having survived the infection. And then life will begin to return to normal. Actually, we're going to enter the second phase of the pandemic that we discussed at the beginning of our talk. We'll have reached this threshold. And by the way, this has to happen the whole world over.
Right. How do you reach people? Because this is also, you know, this feeds into questions of misinformation, distrust of authority, you know, a limits of knowledge, because, you know, public health people didn't know what was going on at various points. And, you know, rather than admit that, because they were afraid that people would panic. They kind of bullshit. How do you reach people who are vaccine hesitant? And I think the latest numbers I saw, it's like about 20% of American adults are, you know, kind of like, I'm not going to get vaccinated. How do you persuade those people, you know, give it a shot?
Well, I think first of all, the people who are vaccine hesitant are a heterogeneous group. They have different sorts of reasons. So some of them, and I think an overarching principle is not to lecture such individuals, but to, first of all, listen to them, and then try to address whatever their concerns are as reasonably as possible. So some people will say, I'm worried because this vaccine was developed very hastily. And you can say, you're right. It was developed hastily. That's correct. But let me tell you why I'm not worried about that. Or other people will say, well, I'm worried that this is a new technology. You're right. It is a new technology. But we have some other vaccines that are old technology. If you like the Sinovac vaccine, the Chinese vaccines are based on technology that's been around for decades. Actually, in one case, for like 100 years. We'd be happy to offer you that vaccine if you'd like it. So some people will say, well, you know, I think the government has little microchips in the vaccine and they're tracking us. About, I think, 10 million Americans hold this belief. And so then,
I bet you don't have a good answer because you're like, these guys are right.
Not correct. And I would say to them, what is it that I could tell you or show you that would persuade you otherwise? Would you like me to squirt some of it under a microscope and you can take a look? Or would you like to put it in some magnets to see if there's anything magnetic? Or even if I did that, would you tell me it's a non-ferromagnetic metal that's in the vaccine? You know, like, how far deep is your delusion in a way? But and some people will say, well, I don't believe I'm going to get it. I'm just going to take my chances. You know, I just don't think it's going to happen to me. Or I'm young. Some people will say, I'm young, therefore I don't need to take it. There's no personal benefit.
What is the argument for people under, you know, the age of 18? I looked at this a month ago or so, but as at the end of September, it was only about 500 people in America under the age of 18 had died of COVID, according to CDC numbers. You know, why should they? How do you convince somebody?
Here's
like
how
that
I would approach that. I would say, death is not a problem of the young from any cause. Death is a problem of the aged. So as a young person under 20, you have a low probability of dying in the next year of all causes. You know, you have a 1 in 5,000 or 1 in 10,000 chance of dying in the next year. But here's the thing. If you get COVID, it goes up by 30%. In other words, your absolute risk is low of all causes. Yes, you could roll the dice, but it's a needless roll of the dice to get COVID. In fact, another way of benchmarking it is to say, at any age that you are, if you would be concerned about being hospitalized with a heart attack, if you're 18 and you said, gee, you have a heart attack, you'd be like, oh, gee, I have a heart attack. I'd be worried about that if I was hospitalized with a heart attack. Or you're 30 or you're 50 or you're 70, so I'd be worried about being hospitalized with a heart attack. COVID is worse, okay, than that at that age. So to the young, and furthermore, to the young people, I would say it's not just about you, yourself. It's about your parents and your grandparents and your neighbors. You know, you can be a vector to other people. Being vaccinated provides is a civic duty.
And it helps not necessarily because you won't contract COVID, although you're probably less likely to, but you help you. It means the disease has fewer places to live.
Yes, and when you're vaccinated, you're less likely to spread it. In other words, once vaccinated, you derive some personal benefit, but you also offer a benefit to others. And both of these are good reasons. By the way, different people, there were some studies that were done early on in the pandemic that showed that some people were more motivated. Like, they didn't really care about whether they got it themselves, but when you told them, actually, if you get vaccinated, you help others, they're like, oh, okay, then I'll do it. You know, like blood donors, right? We're an amazing country. We have millions of Americans every year go through the irritation and tedium of being blood donors.
I hate to say, you know, like, you know, trying to tease some, you know, a rose growing out of, you know, tragedy here or something like that. But is it possible that one good outcome from this is that if our political class, if our expert class, as well as the citizenry, kind of move to a point where they're more willing to be honest and open and to engage in conversation about things they disagree on?
God, wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't it be nice if we had a spirited public debate that was bound by rules of logic, reason, and fact,
and decorum,
and some decorum. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's going to be rough and tumble, but but where we realize that, you know, people of goodwill, of different ideology than I, it's like, there was that incredible scene in the West Wing where, you know, they had this conservative young woman who was there, and she was, and you know, and there was, and she just pointed out that, like, you know, both of us dislike, would like to do something about poverty. We both think it's bad that there's poverty. We have a difference of opinion about how to go about fixing the problem. And you see, this is lost now. You know, I see all this finger pointing. And so I think the ability to have such a conversation nationally where we say, okay, here are the trade-offs. Like, for example, if the American people had said, you know what? We are willing to lose an extra 30,000 Texans so that we can go to our rodeos. I think the public is allowed to make that vote and that determination, but it had to be properly framed. I say, really, that's what you want? I think most people thought, oh, well, we can have our cake and eat it too. We can just go about our business, denial, remember denial, pretend like nothing is happening. That's false. A deadly germ is circulating. It is a new thing. It wasn't there before. The world has changed, and it's immature to imagine that we can just go about our business with no price. If you're willing to take the price, if you're willing to say, you know what, same thing with schools right now. So the question is, should we wear masks in schools or not? And I think both sides are screwing up this conversation because it's not a trivial thing. You know, to have 4 and 5 and 6 year olds wear masks, it's difficult to educate kids while they're wearing a mask. And they don't wear it very competently anyway. So it's unclear why we're forcing them to do that. On the other hand, there's some benefit maybe, or there's some evidence that there's some benefit. So we should just, for me, it's a technocratic question. We just do a cost-benefit assessment. We say, okay, here, there are benefits and costs to both strategies. It sucks that we have to make this choice. We wish we didn't. But we're going to just have to approach it in a very pragmatic, non-ideological way and then be clear about what we're willing. We're willing to have this many extra people die. And it's some small number or some big number. What's that number? In exchange for keeping schools open or having the kids unmasked or whatever it is.
This seems to be a question in public health. Depending on the moment and who was talking went missing, that there's a cost-benefit analysis, because a lot of the times it seemed that the only thing that was going on was trying to stop death at all, you know, at all costs.
Yeah, no, but the same thing.
Actually, it's a more complicated calculation.
Yes, and this was some of the right wing argument, was that closing businesses impoverishes people and poverty is deadly, which is usually the left wing argument.
Right. Just very quickly, because we only have a couple minutes left. This is a weird kind of segue, but you recently joined the Advisory Council of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, which, you know, speaks up for faculty and students in colleges that are getting a raw deal. You famously were at the center, you know, years ago.
Thank goodness, years ago, of
a campus controversy. Yeah. But I guess one of the, what are you hoping to do with FIRE? And tell me what that is, and then I'm going to try to bring it back in as I'm going to wrangle it to the ground, like I'm at a rodeo and I'm roping a steer to bring it back into the COVID discussion. But what drew you to FIRE?
I mean,
and
I think,
what are you hoping to accomplish?
I think FIRE is an extraordinary organization. It is nonpartisan. It regularly defends people on the right and on the left who are being denied due process or being denied their speech rights at universities, particularly universities that profess to respect those rights, which are often deeply hypocritical about it. And I care a lot about universities in general. I think that it'll sound very self-serving and parochial because I'm a professor, but I do believe that universities are a hallmark of our civilization. The fact that we have our universities are the best in the world. They are. And they reflect our commitment to openness, our commitment to reason, our commitment to science, our commitment to knowledge, the preservation of knowledge, not just scientific knowledge. We preserve Sanskrit. We preserve ancient Norwegian stories. We preserve knowledge in our universities. They are arguably the driver of our wealth and security, everything from pharmaceutical innovations to nuclear weapons. For better or worse, these things relied on the innovations that took place in universities. And so I think these institutions are worth defending and worth protecting. And I do see them as a bit under threat right now from some of the disrespect for their core values and commitments. And these core values and commitments include free and open expression, freedom of assembly. In addition to that, they include a kind of commitment to reason and reason discourse. And I think those are under threat and they need to be protected because universities, I think, need to be protected. And so FIRE, I think, is doing a fantastic job of this. And I was very honored when they asked me to join their advisory council, and I hope to make myself useful. I don't think FIRE, I see it as much less ideological than, for example, the ACLU has become, an organization I deeply respected for years. But over the last 10 years, I think they have kind of lost their way a little bit. And whereas I don't think FIRE is not like that. I think FIRE is a very nonpartisan and is very meat and potatoes. You know, we are defending due process and free expression.
Do you feel is, you know, you've been teaching now for 30 plus years, right? Yeah. So do you feel like the things are getting a little bit better, or is it, you know, darkness?
No, I don't think it's getting better yet. I think the pendulum will swing, but I don't think we've turned a corner. I'm beginning to see some signals that we're turning the corner. I mean, I'm seeing more people speak up. I'm seeing more faculty act with greater bravery. But I am still seeing some crazy cases, that are just, really stunning. You know, the Dorian Abbott case at MIT is just a stunning case. This man who's a planetary scientist is opposed to certain types of affirmative action. He published an essay in Newsweek in which he articulated views that are held by the majority of Americans. For example, even 57% of Californians agreed with some of the positions. So the point is that Dorian Abbott articulated views that are within the Overton window, not very extreme, just sort of, kind of centrist ideas that, we should have a meritocratic system. We should have no discrimination against people, but we should not be seeking equal outcome. We should have equal opportunity, basically. So he articulates these views, and then he's invited to give a talk at MIT on the climate of exoplanets, a totally different, his expertise. And because he held political views that he had published, some students objected. They thought that his invitation was dignifying him, giving him an honor, and they exercised a kind of heckler's veto. And MIT, despite its stated commitments to free expression, MIT is an elite, a prized institution. We should all care about MIT, all of us, whether we've been to MIT is the driver of wealth and security of our nation. It is a magnificent place. It collapsed. They disinvited this guy. And then they said, and it had nothing to do. He wasn't there to speak about his political beliefs. He was there to speak about his science. It's dangerous. This is very dangerous development.
And it's obviously highly selective. I mean, my doctorate's in literary and cultural studies, and I got it in the late 80s, early 90s. Everybody was tracing everything back to Martin Heidegger, who somehow was not written out of polite conversation despite being a Nazi. I mean, an actual card-carrying Nazi. So to bring this back, though, to the COVID, and one of the main thrusts of your book is you talk about misinformation and the way that it circulates. What is the best way to combat misinformation? Because, at various points, the government is spewing misinformation. Other times it might be Fox News or MSNBC, or it might be a politician on the make. In a free and open society, there's going to be a lot of information. And depending on your vantage point and depending on where we are in our procession towards more knowing more or less, it's going to look like fake information, disinformation, misinformation. What's the process by which we squeeze out misinformation?
We have to run the risk, unfortunately. I mean, I do not want, there's nobody, no entity that I can imagine that I would want to give the power to specify what I can say in the public square, or equally important, who I can listen to. I do not want, there's nobody I can think of other than myself that I would trust to decide who I can listen to, who I can read, to whom I can speak. So we cannot have any kind of government exercise of such power, for sure. Now, private industry is different. So there's a lot of debate. I think this is misunderstood, especially on the right. Facebook is a private company. If they want to ban Donald Trump, actually, that is a conservative position. That's what they can do. Or if Twitter, as a private company, wants to say, we have decided that certain kinds of vaccine misinformation are not allowed, that's their right, in my judgment, to do that. Just by the way, I also find the flip-flopping on the right about this in California, that all of a sudden businesses are prohibited from deciding the terms of, you know, whether people should be, their employees should be vaccinated or whether the people...
Right. Or you mean in Texas? And
yes,
Florida.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So anyway, but on the just narrowly on the speech thing, to me, I mean, the answer that I always give is, it's a cliche, is the answer to speech we do not like is more speech. So when I hear misinformation, just like I'm talking, you're not expressing any misinformation, but by talking to you and releasing this video, and to the best of my ability, publicizing factual information that I can support with experiments, with citations, with explanations, with reason and logic and data, I am, you know, releasing into the ether knowledge that I hope will push back against misinformation. And I think that is the way a free and open society must function. I cannot see an alternative to that. So yes, I think we need to push back. And I think for scientists, I think this is something I wanted to say earlier, which I didn't get a chance to say. You alluded to scientists changing their mind. I think the public needs to understand that when scientists change their mind, that's a feature, not a bug. That is exactly what scientists are supposed to do. It is religious figures that are not supposed to change their mind. Scientists, you know, for example, here's the simplest example. Early on in the pandemic, everybody, including me, was worried that the virus could be transmitted through fomites, through physical contact. Remember, we were all washing our hands constantly and cleaning our
packages. Singing happy birthday. I still do it.
You don't need to do that anymore. Hands. The probability of
it's easy to say, it's harder to follow through.
Yes, but we've done all the experiments. Yeah. We did like 6 months of experiments. Yeah. We've done all the epidemiological studies. The number of cases transmitted through physical contact, thank God, are very, very small, are negligibly small. Not enough to justify, you know, wearing gloves in public and cleaning your groceries when they come home. You don't need to do that. We have evidence for that. Now, it cannot be held against me, right? You can't say to me, Nicholas, originally you told us we needed to wash our hands. I'm not. Well, because we've done more science. I've updated. And this is the famous saying, you know, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? You know.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. We've been talking with Nicholas Christakis, whose latest book is Apollo's Arrow, The Profound and Enduring Impact of Coronavirus on the Way We Live. Nicholas, thanks for talking.
Nick, thank you so much for having me back.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.